You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Why pay more for a separate CoQ10 supplement? Enjoy twice the benefits with SuperBeats Heart Chews Advanced. From the number one doctor, pharmacist, and cardiologist recommended beet brand for heart health support, the new SuperBeats Heart Chews Advanced by Human is now infused with CoQ10. That's essentially like getting CoQ10 for free. Our powerful blend of beetroot, grapeseed extract, and CoQ10 ingredients support nitric oxide production, healthy blood pressure, healthy CoQ10 levels, and heart-healthy energy with two tasty chews a day. Plus, SuperBeats Heart Chews Advance are plant-based, so you get heart-healthy energy without stimulants. For a limited time, get a free 30-day supply of SuperBeats Heart Chews on all bundles and 15% off your first order by going to radiobeats.com and using promo code DEAL. That's radiobeats.com, code DEAL.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Hey folks, you know, information is power, so when's the last time you checked your credit scores? Because your scores may change more often than you think, and you should know what they are now and not from a year ago. Credit Karma is here to help out. The best thing? Credit Karma is always free and there's no catch, no credit card needed. So go to creditkarma.com or download the Credit Karma app now. Again, that's creditkarma.com or download the app. And now, enjoy the podcast. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. I'm honored to have as a guest today one of the brightest and most accomplished minds in economics and foreign policy in the world. The Honorable George P. Shultz is one of only two individuals who've held four different presidential cabinet posts. He's taught at three of the country's great universities, MIT, the University of Chicago, and Stanford. And for 8 years, he was president of the Bechtel Group, a major engineering and construction company. He began his career in government service in 1955 as a senior staff economist on the Council of Economic Advisors to President Dwight D. Eisenhower. He then became dean of the University of Chicago's Graduate School of Business and a fellow at the Center for Advanced Study in the Behavioral Sciences at Stanford University before returning to Washington, where he served as Secretary of Labor, Secretary of the Treasury, and the first director of the newly formed Office of Management and Budget under President Richard Nixon. During this period, Shultz also served as chairman of the Council on Economic Policy, negotiated a series of trade protocols with the Soviet Union, and represented the United States at the Tokyo meeting on the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade. He later became chairman of the President's Economic Policy Advisory Board under President Ronald Reagan before serving as Reagan's Secretary of State, playing a key role in implementing a foreign policy that would lead to the successful conclusion of the Cold War and the development of strong relationships between the United States and the countries of the Asia-Pacific region, including China, Japan, and the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. Since then, George Shultz has made his home at Stanford University's Hoover Institution, where he's the Thomas W. and Susan B. Ford Distinguished Fellow. Today, Secretary Shultz joins me for a wide-ranging discussion covering everything from the Cold War and climate change to economics and the Trump tax plan. He recalls his close relationship with his favorite president, Ronald Reagan, and the vital importance of a president and his Secretary of State being on the same page. He talks about Ronald Reagan's Pershing missile moment as a masterclass in peace through strength, and the 1986 Tax Act as a lesson in breaking through partisan gridlock. George Shultz reveals how he knew Mikhail Gorbachev was someone he could do business with. He shares what he saw in a meeting years ago with a young Vladimir Putin, and he suggests that President Trump may soon need to have a Pershing moment of his own. Plus, why Ronald Reagan never bluffed, why foreign policy is a lot like gardening, and why the prospect of nuclear war still keeps this old Cold Warrior up at night. coming up with former Secretary of State George Shultz in just a moment. Today I'm sitting down with former Secretary of State George Shultz, who was Secretary of State under Ronald Reagan for 6.5 years. And fittingly, we're talking at the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library and Museum. Secretary George Shultz, thanks for sitting down with me.
Forward to a little dialogue here.
Well, since we're here at the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library, I want to start by talking to you about your time as Secretary of State under Reagan. Prior to that, you were Secretary of Labor and Secretary of the Treasury. You had a background in economics and had served on the President's Council of Economic Advisers under Eisenhower. Were you at all surprised when Ronald Reagan asked you to become America's top diplomat, given your background in economics?
Well, I had known him for quite a long while. And the first time I had a lengthy conversation was when I got back from having the various cabinet offices. And he was governor of California and invited me up for lunch. And I got a 2.5 hour grilling on how the federal government worked. How do you get something to happen? He was all about execution. How do you make things take place? What is it? I was director of the budget. He said, well, what does the president do? What does the cabinet do? What does the director of budget do? Suppose the president wants to change things. How does he go about that? Very operational, hands-on. So I said to myself, you know, this guy, probably he wants to be president, but he wants to do the job. It isn't just pie in the sky. Do the job. Execute.
So he was the type of leader who concerned himself with the details on the ground, would you say?
Well, it wasn't so much the details. It was how do you get something to happen? If you decide to do something, how do you make it work? Let me give you an example of the way he operated. You may remember that soon after he took office, the air controller struck.
Right, right.
And he took a principled position. He said, they took an oath of office, they violated it, they're out. And all over the world, people said, my God, these are the guys who keep the planes flying. But going back to his time as governor, he understood about execution. And he had as his Secretary of Transportation a man who had been chief executive of a major transportation company, so he understood the problem. And working with the president, they manned the towers with management people and some military. They had an aggressive recruiting and training program, and they kept the planes flying. And all over the world, people said, hey, watch out, the guy plays for keeps. So this instinct for how you execute was right there.
And this was something you yourself knew a little bit about because you had been Secretary of Labor and had dealt with labor disputes prior to that.
So I watched this with admiration.
Now, you knew Milton Friedman from your time at the University of Chicago, and you were a firm believer in free market capitalism. As Secretary of State, how did that inform your approach to dealing with the Soviet Union?
Well, I could see that their economy was going nowhere. And gradually, as I got to be able to talk more about it with Gorbachev, he asked me a lot about, and I described the market to him. As an old-time communist, it was hard for him to think of the market as anything but chaos. And gradually, I had to say, how does the market solve problems? And how does the market solve a problem that is efficient and distributes gains the way you want it to get distributed and so on? And gradually, we had good conversation about it, but it helped me.
What was your first impression of Gorbachev, and what gave you hope that he was different from his predecessors?
The first time I saw him was when we went to the Chernenko funeral, and he had orchestrated this funeral, the new man in charge. He'd met with most other delegations. Our delegation was one of the last to meet with him. And since Vice President Bush was there, he had to carry the meeting, and I had a few things to say on behalf of the president. Mostly I could sit back and watch him, which I did. He had a lot of notes in front of him. He shuffled them around. He never looked at them. And the conversation was very wide-ranging, and it was a real conversation. I had more experience with Soviet leaders than anybody else there, so I had a contrast. Before, when you were talking with them, you said something went by their ear, they said something went by your ear. That's not a conversation.
Yeah.
But Gorbachev engaged. He listened. He responded. He expected you to listen and respond.
So it was so more
I
of a
said
dialogue.
That by people afterwards. This is a very different fan from anybody we've ever dealt with. He's smart. He's quick. He's going to be a tough adversary. But you can converse with him. So you can enter his mind by a conversation. And he is a brilliant man.
Yeah, he certainly is. And I remember you saying that he was someone that we could deal with. Do you think that Putin is someone that we can deal with right now?
Well, first of all, Putin has to have what I call a Pershing moment.
So you're referring to the Pershing missiles in Germany, right?
We deployed ballistic missiles in Germany, and it was a huge undertaking with Soviets walked out of arms control negotiations and banned war talk and so on, but we deployed them. And so all of a sudden they saw our alliance means business. And once they saw that strength, then gradually we'd be able to talk on the basis of that. So I think right now we have to establish that kind of strength before we do any real talking.
So what type of U.S. action do you think would fit the bill?
Well, I'm not close enough to be able to say for sure, but I think we should be arming the Ukrainians with first-class armaments. We don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
But right. They're the boots on the ground. Give them the arms, and they can make some headway. I think that could be a Pershing moment.
I've heard you say that Putin has a weak hand. What do you mean when you say he has a weak hand? Are you referring to the Russian economy or his hold on power?
No, I mean that he has a demographic catastrophe on his hands.
Mm-hmm.
Fertility is low. Longevity has been rising a little bit, but it isn't back up to where the old Soviet was. So his manpower is not as great as it was. His economy is far too dependent on exports of commodities, particularly oil and gas. And the prices have, we all know, come down drastically. They're not going to go back up again. And so he's got that problem. He has a real big problem in the Caucasus.
Mm-hmm.
And so he has plenty of problems. But he has a weak hand, but he's playing it very aggressively. And that's why I think we need a Pershing moment to say to him, okay, stop. You're going to be better off if we work in a constructive way.
Do you feel that we can count on him to be a rational actor in that sense?
I'm not there. I'm not close enough to it to say.
Yeah.
But I had only one meeting with him.
Oh, really?
And this was when we had a track two going with Henry Kissinger and Sam Nunn and myself and a few Bill Perry and a few other people. And Sam said something that triggered him. It was a simultaneous translation. And he carried on for almost a half an hour, one chip on his shoulder after another.
Really?
Most of them I thought were nonsense. Every once in a while he'd say, well, he's got a point there. But finally he stopped. And then I was called upon to say something. And he started up again. I put my hand up. and he stopped. I said, you thought I was getting at this. I was really getting at this. And this is important to your country and to my country. And we ought to talk about it. So then he talked about it. I came away saying, the man is smart, he's young, he'll be around for a while, he's a bully, and if he doesn't have people around him to stand up to him, there's no place where he's going to go.
Yeah, it sounds like you gave him a little bit of your own Pershing moment there.
Well, I did, but it just kind of made me understand him a little bit better, but mm-hmm. I haven't met with him enough to feel I had
sure.
real confidence.
There is this tendency for people to want to frame these current tensions between the U.S. and Russia as a reopening of the Cold War. As someone who lived it, I'm assuming you don't see it that way.
Well, it has the same business of a tension mm-hmm. between the two countries. But the Cold War was in part ideological. There was this Soviet notion that they had a system, communism, that was going to conquer the world, an ideology that they put forward. And if you look at what they did, it didn't work.
Right.
So that was its downfall. But nevertheless, it was more ideological than what we see now.
Are there certain things from your experiences during the Cold War under Reagan that you think might still inform how we approach the relationship with Russia today?
Yes, I think we should be realistic. That was always one of President Reagan's first principles, be realistic.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, he called the Soviet Union an evil empire, and people went bananas. My friend Paul Nitze was testifying before Congress, and they were after him about it. And some senator said, Poe, how can you serve in an administration where the president would call the Soviet Union an evil empire? And Nitze said, Senator, have you considered the possibility that the statement might be accurate? So that ended the hearing. But he was very realistic, and so I think that's where you start. And then you have to be strong. You have to be strong in military terms. We have to build our military up. And you can't have a really strong military unless you have a strong economy. Mm-hmm. And we must get our economy to grow more than it's been growing. Then you have to have strength of purpose where people are behind you and you feel they are on the right track. And Reagan was a master of getting people excited and interested and informed and part of the act. And then you can say, here's what I'm after. Think of what you're after. Don't think of what the other guy wants, or you'll be negotiating with yourself. Think of what you want and then go after it.
Reagan used to talk about peace through strength, but it seems to me that far too often leaders talk about foreign policy as a binary choice between military strength and diplomacy. It doesn't seem to me that that's the way that you and Ronald Reagan approached problems.
Well, I think peace through strength is a good short description.
Yeah.
Because peace is what you're after, and you get it by strength, which is not the same as force. I can remember, I told this story to President Reagan once, he loved it. When I was in Marine Corps boot camp at the start of World War II, I remember the sergeant handed me my rifle. He said, take good care of this rifle, this is your best friend. And remember one thing, never point this rifle at anybody unless you're willing to pull a trigger. Hmm. No empty threats. I can remember times that we'd be sitting in the Situation Room and somebody would say, if that happens, it's unacceptable. And he would say, well, what are you going to do if it happens? The answer is nothing. He said, well, then you accepted it. Don't say it's unacceptable unless you're going to do something about it if it happens.
So President Reagan never bluffed then.
He never bluffed. And if people know that you will pull the trigger if you must, you probably don't have to pull the trigger very much.
Mm-hmm.
But if they're uncertain, they do things, and you get away with murder. I gave the example a little while earlier of the air controllers business. That was an exhibition of strength. And all over the world, people put that down. They said, well, guy's strong. He knows what he's doing. And then we had other examples that I could give. The deployment of the Pershing missiles that we referred to as there was no shot fired, but it was a massive act of strength. And that strength paid off.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with former Secretary of State George Shultz when we come back in just a moment. Hey, folks, if you like Kick-Ass News, then I think you'll really enjoy the Art of Charm podcast, an iTunes Top 50 podcast that's packed with wisdom in the truest sense of the word. From how to become more productive and professional to how to read body language, network, and negotiate, the show basically covers anything that will help you become a high performer at home and at work. And with an armory of powerful weapons like influence and persuasion, it brings together interesting people like Shaq, Russell Brand, Larry King, Neil deGrasse Tyson, and Bill Nye to discuss relationships, attraction, life hacking, and success. Look, if you listen to Kick-Ass News, then clearly you're interested in expanding your horizons and learning from the smartest, most interesting, and accomplished people in their fields. That's what you'll get when you listen to The Art of Charm. The Art of Charm is highly addictive and strives to be fun and educational at the same time. It's not stuffy college professor textbook stuff. Personal growth shouldn't be so boring all the time. This isn't pop psychology and superficial advice. This is a show that offers meaningful, fun, life-changing insights with a practical edge that you can apply right out of the box. You deserve an extraordinary life. Go to theartofcharm.com/podcast or search for The Art of Charm on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts and start taking your life to the next level. I really enjoy this show and I think you will as well. And now, back to the podcast.
I've heard you talk about the importance of having a global policy, not just a policy specific to various regions of the world. How would you describe the Reagan-Shultz unified theory of foreign policy in those terms?
Well, we had a way of approaching problems, and we knew that we were conducting a global diplomacy.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, the Cold War and the Soviet Union part of it was very important, but we developed a very strong relationship with China. We had very good going with Japan and so on around the world. When I heard that we were going to have a pivot to Asia, I said, don't these people understand? We conduct a global diplomacy. We don't pivot anywhere. They pivot to Asia, and what happens? Ukraine, the Middle East explodes. So you have to have your hand everywhere. And what that means is you have to have a strong Department of State and have good embassies with good ambassadors, and the Foreign Service people are terrific as they can help you.
Well, I've heard you use the analogy of gardening to describe diplomacy. Can you elaborate on that analogy a little bit?
Well, if you are a gardener and you plant your seeds and you go away for 6 months and come back, what have you got? Weeds. And you can't get them out without getting everything else out. So any good gardener knows you have to tend the garden, and then you'll have what you want. The same is true in foreign policy. You have to go and get to know people. Garden. Don't just go when there's a big problem. Go when, just so you get to know people. Mm-hmm. And you develop a relationship of trust and confidence. And I did that with Shevardnadze, the Soviet foreign minister. I did that with Wu Chichen, the Chinese foreign minister. And I remember once Shevardnadze asked for private time, and he said, I want you to know that we have decided to leave Afghanistan. We haven't decided when to announce it or when to do it, but we're going to do it. And I'm telling you that so maybe we can talk a little together about how to have it happen in a way that minimizes the loss of human life. He would never have told me that if he didn't trust me. Mm-hmm. He knew I wouldn't go blab it to the press. The only person I told was President Reagan. And it did work out that we were able to do some things that I think was helpful both to Afghan lives and Soviet lives.
And that gets to something that I think Margaret Thatcher once said to you. She said, one thing you can be sure of with Ronald Reagan, if he gives you his word, that's it. And I think one of the things that helped Reagan was his consistency and that his counterparts always knew where he stood and knew that they could trust him. I wonder, in the context of things going on today, do you feel that it's helpful if the president says things like he wants to be unpredictable in terms of his foreign policy, or perhaps rides both sides of an issue like the U.S.-NATO relationship or the one-China policy?
Well, I think you have to be consistent, mm-hmm. and people have to know you mean what you say. I think one of the best things that has been done in this administration is when the Syrians used chemical weapons again, they got clobbered. Mm-hmm. And it was done really professionally. Two ships put their missiles up there, and none of them fired until they were all there. And then they destroyed what amounted to 20% of the Syrian Air Force. They didn't touch the chemical weapons because they didn't want to have them spread around. And they left the Air Force open so the Russian planes could get out. But anybody that looked at that from a military standpoint, see, you know, these guys are pros. Mm-hmm. So it was a very important marker. Mm-hmm. They did what Obama didn't do after they used. He That's drew true. A red line, and when they crossed it, he didn't do anything. And my boot camp analogy shows that he will pull mm-hmm. a trigger.
Talk a little about the relationship with Reagan and the importance of having a Secretary of State who doesn't have any daylight between him and the president.
Well, people would ask me about my foreign policy, and I always said, I don't have one. Mm-hmm. The president has one. My job is to help him formulate it and carry it out. And he and I had two private meetings a week. So we sat together, the two of us, and we talked about whatever, what was coming up, what was on the horizon, how we ought to get it together. He loved to talk about bargaining and negotiating. He was a good negotiator. So I got so I knew how he would think about things. Mm-hmm. And I could really truly represent him as I was going around.
In that sense, when you look at Rex Tillerson saying that we want a diplomatic solution to North Korea and then Trump tweeting that there's no negotiation to be had with little rocket men, meaning Kim Jong-un, do you feel that that's helpful to the situation? I'm assuming not.
Well, it makes it clear to everybody that the Secretary of State does not speak for the president. Mm-hmm. And if you're going to be successful, you're speaking for the president. Then mm-hmm. people take you seriously.
Mm-hmm. to borrow a phrase from Winston Churchill, people should deal with the organ grinder, not the monkey.
Well, okay.
I want to ask you, if you will, to put on your economist hat for a moment here and to talk about the Trump Tax Reform Act. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, it's a very intricate process,
mm-hmm.
and I don't claim to have rolled up my sleeves and tried to understand every part of it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think particularly the corporate tax reductions are very pro-growth.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as all the ins and outs of it, I haven't studied it enough. But I do remember the 1986 Tax Act.
Right.
Here's the way that started. I had been President Reagan's economic advisor before I was Secretary
of
State.
That's right,
yeah. So he asked me if I had any ideas. We're down at the Annenberg Estate. They had wonderful New Year's Eve parties, and President and I always had a December 31st golf game. So I told him at the end of the golf game, I've got an idea for you. So we went in, and I said, Mr. President, there is a free lunch. Oh, yeah? I said, yes, if you will cut the preferences out of the tax system and lower the rates in a commensurate way so it's revenue neutral, and they'll score it as though nothing happens to the economy. When that happens, the economy will expand, and you'll get more revenue than they calculated. That's the free lunch. We talked about it for quite a while, and he bought it. And that started what became the 1986 Tax Act. First, there was what was called Treasury One. It was a pretty good, clean bill. Didn't go anywhere. Then Danny Raskinkowski, and he's chairman of Ways and Means, a Democrat, got interested in the idea of preferences. And the House worked out a bill. It wasn't too good, but it had basic ideas in it. And Bill Bradley, Senator Bill Bradley, got interested in it. And the Senate passed a very good bill, much like Treasury One. And that bill prevailed in the conference. So then it passed the Senate 97-3.
Wow, that's almost unheard of these days.
And somebody asked the president if it bothered him that two Democrats introduced his legislation. You know, he said, it passed, didn't it?
97-3, and now when we look at the current tax reform, the Democratic leadership refused to even show up to the meeting, and we see the president having trouble even wrangling votes on the Republican side. What do you think is the critical difference?
In the case of the 1986 Tax Act, for example, there were extensive hearings. All kinds of proposals were brought up. Witnesses testified. There was a process.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time the process was through, people understood quite well what they were doing, what they were voting on. And the process of back and forth and discussion brought people to a general agreement that this was a good idea. And so then you're voting on a good idea, so you don't have big divisions about it.
What Reagan called the 80% my friend idea?
Well, Reagan always said that he got something. He said, well, if I got 80%, I come back for the next 20% later.
So I never heard that version. Well, I want to talk about the two animating issues of your post-government life, nuclear proliferation and global climate change. With Iran pursuing a nuclear program, ISIS and terrorist groups seeking some form of nuclear weapon, and of course North Korea aggressively working toward a nuclear weapon, what concerns you most that you're seeing right now?
I think there are two big issues,
mm-hmm.
cross-cutting everything, and either one getting out of control can destroy our world. One is nuclear weapons, and the other is climate change.
Mm-hmm.
Now, people seem to have forgotten what a nuclear weapon can do. If a nuclear weapon is dropped in this area, it's incinerated. It's gone. Mm-hmm. Nothing's left.
Yeah.
New York disappeared. Moscow disappeared. They're unimaginably destructive. And there's a man named Bill Swings, a wonderful retired bishop in California. He and I are great friends, and he says, when you put your hand on the Bible and swear to be president of the United States, that's the least of it. Hmm. It's when you put your hand on the nuclear button and you can start something that could kill a million people. You're God.
Wow.
We don't elect God. So nuclear weapons are devastating, and we need to somehow come to grips with it better. And that's the reason why, if we can somehow stabilize things with Russia and get back to discussions with them, that because we and they have the most,
mm-hmm.
so we can lead the way as we did once. The nuclear weapons today are a third of what they were at the time of Reykjavik. But now the problem is they're proliferating. And the more they're spread around, the more chance there is some fissile material will get into terrorist hands and you've got a problem. Wow. So you got that. And the climate is another. There's no question that the climate is getting warmer. It's not a, I don't know how anybody can even debate that, what we see. And at the same time, we see already major events taking place that are the result. And here's an example. We had a wonderful biologist present a paper at a meeting we had at Hoover at Stanford. And she said, as the globe warms, tropical diseases are coming north.
Oh, that's scary.
We should be able to see this coming. We are not getting up our diagnostics. We're not getting up our treatment. And they're spread by mosquitoes. We know how to play around with genes now. Why aren't we getting some of these mosquitoes and see if we can fix them so they don't spread so much? But this is something that's coming. And there are things we can do about it if we are intelligent and work on it.
Yeah, that brings a whole other dimension into global climate change that a lot of people probably aren't thinking about. Reagan was very good at finding a reasonable conservative approach to environmentalism. Could you articulate perhaps an updated conservative take on environmentalism?
Well, in the case of President Reagan, we had a lot of scientists who thought the ozone layer was depleting. Mm-hmm. There were some who doubted it. But they all agreed that if it happened, it would be a catastrophe. And in our private meetings, President Reagan and I talked about this quite a lot. And he became convinced that the scientists who were worried were right. So he did something unusual in today's environment. In today's environment, the people who you don't agree with, you try to vilify them. He put his arm around them and said, okay, you don't agree with us, I respect that. But you do agree that if it happens, it's a catastrophe. So why don't we take out an insurance policy? So that wound up in the Montreal Protocol. And people by now looking back saying it's clear the scientists who were worried were right, and the Montreal Protocol came along just in time. Yeah. So that was a major environmental achievement on the part of President Reagan.
Quite a legacy, and you were a big part of that. Secretary George Shultz, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you.
It was a real honor to have Secretary George Shultz on the podcast. I just want to point out that the man is 97 years old, pushing 100. And as you could tell during the interview, he's sharp as a tack and incredibly insightful and articulate. If I'm even in half the shape that he's in at that age, I'll consider that a win. George Shultz is a fellow at the Hoover Institution, and you can keep up with him and read some of his recent articles by visiting hoover.org. Support for today's show comes from Control GX, the first shampoo that gradually reduces gray from Just for Men. Just use Control GX as you would your regular shampoo until you like what you see. Subtle, natural-looking results. Shampoo in, rinse out, and move on. Most guys get the results they want in about 2 weeks. Look forward to a smart look with Control GX. Get 25% off Control GX using code KICK at controlgx.com. That's code KICK to get 25% off Control GX at controlgx.com. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on iTunes and leave us a review. You can follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at Kick-Ass News Pod. And as always, I welcome your comments, questions, and ideas at comments@kickassnews.com. I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.